Imagine an economy where the usual rules just get thrown out the window. Interest rates are lowered when inflation is soaring high, right?
Yeah.
And the government introduces these completely new financial instruments, just trying to prop up the currency.
Mm-hmm.
What actually happens to the everyday person in that kind of economy? Does everyone feel the same effects, or, you know, do some groups thrive while others find themselves unexpectedly struggling?
That's the core question, really.
So today we're taking a deep dive into exactly that kind of scenario, Turkey's economic journey from 2002 to 2023, a really fascinating period marked by what's been called unorthodox economic policy making.
That's right. And for this deep dive, we've drawn from a really comprehensive academic paper. It meticulously analyzes microdata from the Turkish Statistical Institute, specifically their household budget survey and the survey of income and living conditions.
Okay.
And our mission today is to really understand the complex, sort of multidimensional consequences of these unusual policies. We're looking specifically at different types of inequality, wage, income, and consumption.
And I think you might be genuinely surprised by what the data reveals about, well, who won and who lost.
Definitely some surprises in there.
So to set the stage a bit, Turkey's economy, it's been on quite a roller coaster since about 2018.
Oh, absolutely.
It's faced these severe macroeconomic shocks, like the 2018 exchange rate crisis. And then, of course, the global disruption from the COVID-19 pandemic hit everyone.
Right.
And in response, the government and the Central Bank of the Republic of Turkey, the CBRT, they went down a path that, well, it really diverged from standard international economic prescriptions.
Yeah, what's truly striking here is how the CBRT broke from the norm.
Yeah.
I mean, when most central banks were aggressively raising interest rates to fight inflation.
Which is global, yeah.
Exactly. Turkey did the opposite. They lowered them, even as prices continued to just skyrocket.
Just, wow.
And on top of that, the government introduced something called the Foreign Exchange Protected Deposits, or KKM.
KKM.
Imagine this. You put your money in a Turkish lira account, but the government effectively promises that if the lira's value drops against, say, the dollar, your deposit will automatically be topped up.
So it's like insurance.
Kind of like a free taxpayer-funded insurance policy for your savings,
Yeah.
The aim was to try and stabilize the lira, reduce the pressure.
So, okay, on one hand, you had these unconventional monetary policies like the interest rate cuts and the KKM. But on the other hand, the government was also making really substantial increases to the minimum wage.
Huge increases.
The research tells us these hikes directly affected more than two-fifths of all wage earners. That's a massive number.
It is. It's a really interesting, almost contradictory mix of policies, isn't it?
Absolutely. And this raises a really important question, which the paper digs into. While the big picture effects of these interventions have been studied, you know, the aggregate stuff, how they actually trickle down to affect different groups of people, the distributional consequences that's largely remained unexplored, especially in emerging markets like Turkey.
Exactly. Which makes this period, as the paper highlights, a unique sort of natural experiment. It lets us see the real-world impact of these heterodox policies on inequality.
Okay, so let's dive into that. Our first big discovery, and this one is kind of a head-scratcher. Despite all the economic chaos and these unorthodox policies, wage inequality in Turkey actually declined steadily.
Yeah, steadily over two decades, including right through this recent period of policy experimentation.
That's pretty counterintuitive, isn't it? You'd expect more volatility, maybe more inequality.
It really is. And what truly stands out here is the strong link between this decline and the real minimum wage. The research shows an almost perfect inverse relationship, like a negative 0.896 correlation between wage dispersion and the real minimum wage.
Wow, negative 0.896. That's incredibly strong.
It is. To put it simply, the more the real minimum wage went up, the more wage gaps narrowed. And this is especially impactful because, as you said, a significant chunk, 44% of Turkish employees earn at or near the minimum wage in 2023.
44%.
Yeah. And Turkey's minimum to median wage ratio, it's among the highest globally. So those minimum wage hikes, like that huge 30% increase back in 2016 when inflation was only around 8%,
right,
they really compressed the wage distribution.
Right. So that's a huge lever they were pulling. And it wasn't just the minimum wage, right? Broader economic cycles played a part too.
That's true. Wage inequality often tends to be countercyclical, meaning it decreases during economic expansions.
Yeah.
And Turkey's economy, despite the shocks, did experience notable GDP growth spurts.
Yeah.
11.4% in 2021.
Huge.
0.5% in 2022 and 5.1% in 2023. These periods of recovery coincided with the measured indicators of wage inequality hitting their lowest levels.
And the data backs that up.
Yeah, the data shows a statistically significant negative 0.60 correlation between the Gini coefficient for wages and GDP growth.
Okay, maybe we should quickly explain the Gini coefficient for listeners.
Good idea. So the Gini coefficient is just a standard measure of inequality. It ranges from 0 to 1. 0 means perfect equality, everyone earns the same. 1 means perfect inequality, one person earns everything.
Got it. So a declining Gini for wages means wages were becoming more equal across the board.
Exactly.
But here's where it gets really interesting, particularly when we look at the so-called college premium. You'd naturally expect, I think, that as more people get university degrees, their relative earnings would go up, right? Yeah. That's the incentive.
That's the standard assumption, yeah. More skills, higher pay relative to others.
Well, despite a dramatic increase in educational attainment in Turkey, the proportion of adults with at least a university degree more than doubled, from like 9% in 2004 to 25% in 2023.
Which is a huge shift in the workforce.
Huge shift. But the data shows a surprising decline in the relative earnings of these university graduates. For example, the average earnings for a college graduate fell from 2.15 times the minimum wage in 2019 to just 1.61 times in 2023.
So the gap between a graduate's wage and the minimum wage actually shrank.
Right. The premium eroded. What does the research suggest is going on there?
Well, the paper suggests a couple of potential factors. One is the very rapid expansion of universities, especially after 2006. It's possible this rapid growth might have led to maybe a decline in the average quality of education at some institutions.
More graduates, but maybe not all equally prepared for high-skill jobs.
Potentially. Another factor mentioned is a possible stagnation of overall educational quality since the Great Recession. It's not just an abstract number. It's a real shift that could impact career paths and incentives for a whole generation.
And this wasn't felt equally across all higher-skilled jobs, was it?
No, the analysis points out that professionals think doctors, engineers, lawyers experienced the most significant wage decline relative to the minimum wage during this unorthodox policy period. Their median wage fell by a substantial 25.1%, from 2.39 times the minimum wage in 2019 down to 1.79 times in 2023.
25% drop relative to the minimum.
Wow. Compare that to associate professionals, who saw a smaller, though still significant, 15.6% decline. It really highlights a particular vulnerability for those top-tier skilled labor earnings during this specific time.
Okay, so summing up that part. Wage inequality surprisingly went down, largely driven by minimum wage hikes and maybe some cyclical effects, but the value of a college degree, that premium, actually eroded.
That's a good summary. A very complex picture just within wages.
All right, so if wage inequality declined, what happened with overall income inequality? Did that follow the same path?
Ah, well, that's where the story diverges. While wage inequality declined, income inequality told a different story. It did fall initially, you know, before 2018, but less dramatically than wages did. And then it actually reversed in recent years, showing a slight upward trend.
Okay, so it went down and then started creeping back up.
Exactly. For instance, the Gini coefficient for income, using the household budget survey data, it went from 0.45 back in 2002, dipped to a low of 0.38 in 2019, but then rose back up to 0.40 in both 2022 and 2023.
So higher than its lowest point. Remember, a higher Gini means more inequality.
Correct. More unequal income distribution overall in those recent years.
This raises a really important question then. If wages were getting more equal, what's driving this increase in overall income inequality? What else is in income besides wages?
Right. The paper attributes this divergence largely to widening disparities in capital income and entrepreneurial income, things like profits from businesses, rent, dividends, interest. These are, of course, excluded from the wage calculations we just discussed.
And the inequality in those income sources.
It's high and didn't decline. In fact, it potentially increased. The Gini coefficients for these non-labor incomes are striking. For example, the capital income Gini went from 0.89 in 2005 up to 0.93 in 2023 based on HBS data.
Whoa, 0.93, that's incredibly high. Close to maximum inequality.
Extremely concentrated, yes. And the research explains this concentration or the potential increase in it through something it calls the extensive margin.
The extensive margin, what's that?
Basically, it means the increase in inequality wasn't necessarily because the rich got vastly richer from capital, although that might be part of it. It was primarily driven by a rising share of households reporting zero capital or entrepreneurial income over time.
Ah, so fewer and fewer people were getting any income from these sources.
Precisely. Think about it. The percentage of households reporting absolutely no capital income increased from 70% in 2002 to 79% in 2023, according to the HBS data. So more households are just not participating in those wealth-generating income streams at all, which mathematically increases the concentration among those who do have that income.
That makes sense. It concentrates the gains among fewer people.
Exactly.
We should probably add a small caveat here, right? Measuring these non-labor income types is tricky.
Very tricky. Surveys often struggle with what researchers call the missing rich phenomenon. Wealthier households might be underrepresented in surveys or might underreport their income, especially capital gains.
So the real concentration might be even higher than the data shows.
It's possible. Also, the paper includes a note of caution regarding potential underreporting among low-income groups in one of the specific data sets, the SILC, for the most recent years. These are important nuances to keep in mind when we're looking at the numbers. Data collection always has its challenges.
Definitely. Okay, so wage inequality down, income inequality down, then slightly up, driven by non-labor income. Now, what about consumption? How much people were actually able to buy?
Now this is arguably the most striking finding of the entire deep dive. Consumption inequality rose dramatically during the unorthodox policy period.
Dramatically?
Yes. And critically, the increase in consumption inequality exceeded the growth in income inequality we just talked about.
Okay, unpack that. The gap in what people were spending grew even wider than the gap in their incomes.
Exactly. The numbers really paint a vivid picture here. The Gini coefficient for consumption, using that HBS data again, it surged from 0.38 in 2019 to a much higher 0.45 in 2023.
0.38 to 0.45, that's a big jump.
Huge jump. Meanwhile, remember, income inequality's Gini was lower, at 0.40 in 2023. So the gap in what people were actually able to buy and consume grew significantly wider than the gap in the reported incomes.
So what was driving that? What were people spending money on differently?
The primary driver, according to the analysis, was a sharp expansion in durable goods consumption, specifically among the wealthiest households, those in the top decile, the top 10%.
Durable goods, so cars, appliances, furniture, big ticket items.
Exactly. To give you a concrete example, the share of durable goods in the total consumption basket for that top decile jumped from 0.42 or 42% in 2019 to 0.52, 52% in 2022. They were spending a lot more of their money on these large lasting items.
52% on durables. Wow. And what about lower income groups?
A stark contrast. Lower income groups, who are obviously facing tighter financial constraints, saw their share of durable goods expenditures actually decline. For instance, the lowest decile share fell from 0.28 down to 0.24 over the same period.
So the rich bought more big stuff, the poor bought less. Yeah. Why? What's the hypothesis there?
Well, one plausible idea put forward is that wealthier households were actively seeking to hedge against the high inflation.
Ah.
If your currency is losing value rapidly, buying a tangible asset like a car or a high-end appliance can seem like a way to preserve wealth. And crucially, these households likely had better access to credit markets and more liquid assets to make these purchases possible.
It's a classic inflation hedge by something real. While lower income households maybe didn't have the cash or credit to do that.
That seems to be the implication. And the analysis shows something else related to this. Lower income percentiles actually experienced higher income growth during parts of this period, likely due to those minimum wage hikes we discussed.
Right.
But they had lower consumption growth compared to the upper percentiles. This led to a really marked contrast in how much consumption grew between the top and bottom.
So their incomes went up, but their spending didn't keep pace, while the rich spent more freely.
In relative terms, yes. To give you a truly striking statistic, the paper highlights. The growth difference in consumption between the 5th percentile, near the bottom, and the 90th percentile, near the top, reached a massive 33 percentage points in 2022 alone.
33 points difference in consumption growth in 1 year. That's huge.
It really underscores the divergence.
And this shows up in the consumption to income ratio too, right? How much of their income people were spending.
Exactly. While wealthier households generally maintained a similar proportion of income allocated to consumption, poorer households actually experienced a reduction in their consumption to income ratio. They were spending a smaller share of their income.
Saving more or just unable to spend?
Well, the most substantial drop in this ratio for poorer households happened in 2022. Just to illustrate, the 90th percentile saw about a 10% increase in their consumption to income ratio during this period, while the 5th percentile experienced a staggering 40% decrease.
A 40% decrease. So why? Why would lower income households spend less even if their income rose a bit?
The research suggests a few potential reasons. One is precautionary savings. Lower-income households are often more vulnerable to economic shocks and uncertainty. Facing high inflation and unorthodox policies, they might anticipate prolonged economic hardship and decide to save more, even if it means cutting back on current consumption.
Bracing for impact, basically.
Could be. Another, perhaps simpler reason is that they may just face more severe difficulties in accessing credit compared to wealthier households. Buying durable goods often requires loans or savings, which might have been out of reach.
Right. Access to credit is key.
Definitely.
It's worth adding a quick note on 2023 specifically. The data for that year shows a surprising real increase in both consumption and income across all deciles.
Yeah, that was a bit unusual given the trends.
While some genuine gains might have happened, perhaps boosted by more government wage increases or election spending, the research also notes caution. It's possible this could be partly influenced by potential underreporting of the true inflation rate by the Turkish Statistical Institute that year. If inflation was actually higher than reported, these real gains might be smaller or even illusory.
That's an important caveat. Measuring inflation accurately, especially during volatile periods, is notoriously difficult, and official statistics can sometimes lag behind or face methodological questions.
Okay, so let's try to pull this all together. We've looked at wages, income, and consumption. What's the big takeaway from this deep dive into Turkey's experience?
Well, I think the key takeaway is crystal clear. These kinds of unorthodox macroeconomic policies generate really complex and, importantly, multidimensional distributional consequences.
Meaning you can't just look at one number.
Exactly. Relying on a single metric, like just wage inequality or just average income growth, can really obscure critical aspects of how different groups within society are actually affected by major economic changes and policies. You get a completely different story depending on whether you look at wages, income, or consumption.
Right. And that has big implications for policymakers, especially in emerging economies facing similar pressures, doesn't it?
Absolutely. This deep dive really highlights the crucial need for systematic distributional impact assessments to be done alongside the usual aggregate policy evaluations.
So don't just ask, did GDP grow, but who benefited from that growth?
Precisely. Turkey's experience demonstrates that even if unconventional measures achieve certain stabilization goals, and that's debatable in itself, their distributive effects can be really substantial, often unintended, and can create winners and losers in surprising ways. It's not just about the economy as a whole, but about the lives within it.
And we saw some potentially lasting structural shifts too, like that decline in the college wage premium.
Yeah, that's a really notable transformation. If that trend continues, it could weaken incentives for people to pursue higher education and invest in human capital in the long run. If a degree doesn't guarantee a significantly better income relative to the minimum wage, what does that signal to future generations?
That's a serious long-term consideration. Furthermore, that consumption pulling forward behavior, especially among the wealthy, buying durable goods, and the role of schemes like the KKM, which protected certain types of savings, it does suggest that these policies might have, perhaps inadvertently, subsidized wealth preservation for those who were already financially better positioned.
Yeah, it raises questions about whether these policies disproportionately help those with assets to protect, while potentially leaving others more exposed to inflation or economic uncertainty. It shows how even policies that might seem neutral or broadly targeted on the surface can have complex ripple effects on who benefits most.
So to recap, we've seen how Turkey's journey through unorthodox economic policies led to this fascinating complex array of outcomes. A surprising decline in wage inequality, partly thanks to minimum wage hikes.
Right.
A more nuanced picture for income inequality, which fell, then rose slightly, seemingly fueled by concentrated capital and entrepreneurial gains, or rather the lack thereof for most people.
Mm-hmm. The extensive margin effect.
And then this really dramatic surge in consumption inequality, driven largely by the wealthiest buying up durable goods, possibly as an inflation hedge, widening the gap in actual living standards.
A truly multifaceted picture.
So thinking about all this, what stands out most to you, our listener, about these findings? How might understanding these kinds of multifaceted impacts change the way we evaluate economic policies, especially in today's world of, you know, growing information access, but also intense financial volatility?
It was worth pondering.
Think about how these unexpected consequences, these differential impacts, can reshape an economy, not just in the broad strokes we usually hear about, but really from the ground up in the everyday economic lives of different kinds of people.